sermons. I encourage you guys to seek them out and seek the Lord next Sunday. So today's sermon is from 2 Chronicles chapter 16. I want you guys to turn your Bibles to 2 Chronicles chapter 16. Chronicles comes after Kings. And I kind of stick your finger there for now, because the majority of our sermon is actually going to be from 2 Chronicles 16. But last week during Sunday Swim, which is our prayer meeting, I mentioned a verse that just came to my head. I talked about it. We prayed about it. And then I went home, and then that verse just continued to stick in my heart. And God took me back to it and kept on reminding me and just started to bring it up to my surface and to really kind of chew on it. So He gave me a word, and it's from 2 Chronicles. When you look at 2 Chronicles and the book of Kings, like you look at the Chronicles and the Kings, they're historical books. They cover much of the same history, the history of Israel. They both record the lives of the kings and the rulers of Israel. Okay, however, there are also very significant differences between Kings and Chronicles, and who wrote them and when they wrote them and what perspective that these books were written. And when you look at the book of Kings, it's considered a part, I'm giving you a little bit of background here, it's part of the Deuteronomistic history, running from the end of Deuteronomy through Joshua, Judges, and Samuel, and ending with Kings. Scholars believe that it's a part of a set, okay? Loosely edited collection of works with different authors, but considered part of a set. There's a school of thought that say that it's a single literary work. But the general idea is that these books come in a set, the Encyclopedia Britannica. You know, you can't just buy one; it just comes part of this set. Now, Kings, 1 and 2 Kings, which actually is just one book, it got split up for our benefit when the Bible was made. Is Kings focuses on the part of history from the death of David, the rule of Solomon, and then the divided kingdom, and the author records both lines of history, northern and southern. So when you read Kings, you see what, it's just like a correlation. Like, this is what happened in Israel. He was the king, and he did these bad things. And then they go, well, this is what happened in Judah. And this is, you know, because it divided Israel and Judah. Judah and Benjamin were the only tribe that became part of the southern kingdom. And so there's a correlation between the northern and southern kingdom and what happens. And it ultimately shows the destruction of the southern kingdom and them going into exile. Now, the focus of these set of books of Kings is, and the Deuteronomic history is God's covenant and law over the people of Israel and the people's apostasy, like falling away from the Lord, falling away and failing to meet his law and leading to suffering and destruction. Kings focuses on a part of history, and it tells us that of the representation of Israel as a whole. Now, Chronicles, Jewish and Christian traditions points to Ezra as the author. He's the author of Ezra and Nehemiah. And it's considered more of a recent historical book, having some of these other books to draw from. Now, Chronicles goes way back to Adam and Eve. When you read Chronicles, it starts from the genealogy from Adam and Eve. And like the first, like, how many chapters is just all genealogy. If you've ever read it, I had to read it when I was going to school. But if you ever read it, it's a lot of names. And just traces genealogy. And it traces the genealogy all the way from Adam to the rise of the Israelite monarchy. Covers the rule of David, the genealogy of David and Solomon. And then after the Davidic kingdom, mainly records history of the southern kingdom of Judah. Now, and it leads to the destruction and the exile into Babylon. So now that's kind of like when, you know, if you've ever read Old Testament, you realize that when you read Chronicles, you realize, well, I read this almost the same thing in 1 Kings, or I read this almost the same thing in 2 Kings. It's because they're similarly both historical books that focus on the same time in history, but with different objectives, different authors, and different points of view. Now, I bring this up because I had this lady, she is the wife of the lead pastor of our Korean church back in Seoul, Jaejeol Seongdo. We were founded under Jaejeol Seongdo. She's this really fiery, very small woman. Like this tall, but she's a fiery woman of God. And she, her and her husband, the lead pastor, Pastor Wang, they founded the church in the 70s and were the lead pastors for the 40 years. They're recently retiring. And I had a chance to really kind of be under her because when I came out of the army, like the Korean army, I joined the Korean army, I did this thing called like public service for 2 years to fulfill my medical, I mean not medical, my military criteria in Korea. Right when that ended, she called me one day and said, can I have lunch with you? And so I went, I sat down, we had lunch together. Didn't know her very well, but she said, I want you to work for my preschool. She has a preschool in the part of the church. And then as I started working for the preschool, she really kind of took me under her wing. And she really, like, in a sense, it felt like she was grooming me for something. I don't know what. But we had a very, like, you know, she just really, like, loved on me and really wanted to teach me. And she was an amazing woman of God. And she travels the world. They founded NPWM, which is a very powerful mission organization that reaches pastors all throughout Asia, hundreds of pastors throughout Asia, supports them, raising churches. And so this little fiery woman took me and my a sister from our church, Lisa, who was was working for NPWM at the time, and then some other people, and sat us down. We had a Bible study one day. And we had a Bible study. She teaches us. Her Korean is not, her English isn't that great. It's really good, but she would teach us. And then at the end of one of the things, she said, yes. Like, oh, this is how she talks. Oh, I found something so good. Who knows, Samuni? I found something so good. And when you read Kings, and then you read Chronicles, and you read the two, and then when you find the difference, and she's, oh, so good. I want to tell you about it. It's so good. But then she forgot to tell us about it. And then she just never really got around to it because she's very busy. She travels the world, and I think we were supposed to meet for another Bible study, but she flew off to the Philippines. And so it never kind of, we didn't have that Bible study after that. But that really stuck in my mind. And so as God took me back to 2 Chronicles, God reminded me of what Samuel told me about the difference. Find the difference. And so I went back and I actually read 1 Kings chapter 15, 9. So I want you to actually go to 1 Kings chapter 15. And we're going to read from 9 down, okay? And this is the rule of Asa. Asa is one of the kings that came after Solomon. And he ruled over Judah, the southern kingdom. And we're going to read this. I'll read one verse and you guys all read one verse, okay? Here we go. In the 20th year of Jeroboam, king of Israel, Asa began to reign over Judah. And Asa did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as David his father had done. He also removed Makkah, his mother, from being queen mother because she had made an abominable image of Asherah. And Asa cut down her image and burned it at the brook Kidron. And he brought into the house of the Lord the sacred gifts of his father and his own sacred gifts, silver and gold and vessels. So there's a war between the northern and the southern kingdom. Baasha, king of Israel, went up against Judah and built Ramah that he might permit no one to go out or come in to Asa, king of Judah. So he goes and gives his money to the king of Syria, says, let there be a covenant between me and you, and let there, as there were, was between my father and your father, behold, I am sending to you a present of silver and gold. Go break your covenant with Baasha, king of Israel, that he may withdraw from me. You guys are doing great. And when Baasha heard of it, he stopped building Ramah and he lived in Tirzah. Now the rest of all the acts of Asa and all his might and all that he did in the cities that he built, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the King of Judah? But in his old age, he was diseased in his feet. He had jacked up feet. Okay, let's stop right there. All right, so Asa, okay, when we read this, this is the reign of Asa in 1 Kings, okay? When you read this, he seems like a good king, okay? He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. Okay, he reigned for 41 years. That's a long reign. Okay? It's not like he reigned for 7 years and somebody tried to usurp him. He reigned for 41 years. He put away the prostitutes and the idols. Okay, he removed his mother from being queen because she made an abominable image of Asherah, okay? The high places were not taken down. These are high places that Solomon built for his wives to worship outside of the city. Although those were not taken down, nevertheless, the heart of Asa was wholly true to the Lord. Now, with the war, when there was a war between Israel, he takes silver and gold and sends it to the king of Syria and says, go against Israel so that they will back off from us. And it works. He's like, yes! And he makes this proclamation. They take the stones and the timber that the Israel were building at Ramah, and then they come and they build their own structures. And when I read 1 Kings and about Asa in 1 Kings, he's a man. Okay? For 41 years, he's one of the good kings. Because when you read before this, his fathers and his father's father, they did evil in the eyes of the Lord. They talk about how they did evil, they did the same evil that their fathers did and fell into the same idolatry. So you look at Asa and, man, he's one of the good guys, okay? Now let's read 2 Chronicles, and I know it's a lot, so we're not going to read it together. But it starts from chapter 14. Turn to chapter 14, verse 2, and it says, and Asa did what was good and right in the eyes of the Lord his God. Check, okay? Very good. Let's go to chapter 15, verse 8. And it says, as soon as Asa heard these words, the prophecy of Azariah, the son of Oded, he took courage and put away the detestable idols from all the land of Judah and Benjamin and from the cities that he had taken in the hill country of Ephraim and repaired the altars of the Lord and was in front of the vestibule of the house of the Lord. So now he tears down the idols. Okay, he has a zeal. He tears down the idols. Chapter 15, verse 16, it says, when Maacah, his mother, king of Asa, was removed from being queen mother because she had made a detestable image for Asherah, saying, his mom, his very own mom, makes this idol for Asherah, and he's like, all right, I'm going to destroy this idol, and I'm actually going to keep you from becoming queen mother. That's a bold move, right? It's a zealous man, okay? It also talks about in verse 17, where it says, but the high places were not taken away out of Israel. Nevertheless, the heart of Asa was wholly true all his days. He has a true heart, a whole heart for the Lord. And then in the same way, when we read about it in chapter 16, okay, it talks about how in the 36th year of the reign of Asa, Baasha, king of Israel, went against Judah, and the same thing, they record the same history. He goes and takes gold and silver and sends it to the king of Syria, saying, you know what? Your father and our father, we had a covenant. I want you to stand on this covenant, and you go against Israel so that they'll back off from us. And that same thing happens, and huzzah, he's victorious. Okay? But there is a difference in the two accounts. Okay, and this is, like, when you look at it at face value, up to this point, if you had to give him a king grade, what would you give him? Like, I would give him, like, A minus. No, if you compare it, if he was graded on a curve, like, if you look at what his fathers and his father's fathers said, he'd get, like, an A minus, you know? I would give him a very, like, maybe a B plus if he was a harsh grader, but he was a good king. Okay, although the high places were not taken away, his heart was whole, and he did what was right for the Lord. But here's the difference in the two accounts, and this is where that good stuff comes in. Up to this point, we've seen and heard what man sees in Asa. It's how he would see himself, are his accomplishments, his accolades. And anyone that knew Asa back then, if you were reading a newspaper, the Hebrew Times, Judah Chronicles, whatever it is, the Judah Herald, and you read about King Asa, these are the accolades that would come up for him. These are the things that he accomplished. Okay, these are the things that were on paper. But in 2 Chronicles 16:7, we see how God sees it. Now I'll read it to you. Let's turn to 16, 2 Chronicles chapter 16, verse 7, and we're going to see how God sees this. Okay. At that time, Hanani, the seer, came to Asa, king of Judah, and said to him, because you relied on the king of Syria and did not rely on the Lord your God, the army of the king of Syria has escaped you. Were not the Ethiopians and the Libyans a huge army with very many chariots and horsemen? Yet because you relied on the Lord, he gave them into your hand. For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to give strong support to those whose heart is blameless towards him. You have done foolishly in this, for from now on you will have wars. Then Asa was angry with his seer and put him in the stocks in prison, for he was in a rage with him because of this. And Asa inflicted cruelties upon some of the people at the same time. The acts of Asa, from the first and the last, are written in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel. The 39th year of his reign, Asa was diseased in his feet. There's that messed up feet again. And his disease became severe, yet even in his disease, he did not seek the Lord, but sought help from physician. And Asa slept with his fathers, dying in the 41st year of his reign. Now, I believe there's a lesson in these two accounts of history. The lesson is to see what God sees. See how he sees. And to look for what God is looking for. And to do that. Because when I read Asa's history in 1 Kings and most of 2 Chronicles, he's a king that wants to do right by God. In much of his actions and his attitudes, even his heart was to follow God's instructions. But in 1 Kings, with the war with Israel and how he handles it, although it seems like a political and military tactic that succeeds, the point where God sees things is very differently. And it's at these moments where we need to be alert. We have to be careful. And we have to be very discerning. We might have the purest heart and the best intentions, but what we deem as a success might be seen by God as a failure because God has different criteria. When we look at Asa's life, for the most part of his life, he sought after the Lord. When you look at in chapter 14, verse 9 of 2 Chronicles, there's an Ethiopian army that comes against him. They say it's a million-man army. Okay? A million-man army comes against him with 300 chariots. And what does he do? He calls upon the name of the Lord. He cries out to the Lord, Lord, save us. And what does he do? God uses the army of Judah to rout them and destroy them, and they're victorious. Chapter 15, Asa hears a prophetic word from God through Assyria about turning to God and seeking God. And what does he say? Chapter 15, verse 8, I'll read it to you. As soon as Asa heard these words, the prophecy of Assyria, the son of Oded, he took courage and put away the detestable idols from all the land of Judah and Benjamin. He brings religious reform. He cleanses his kingdom. But when Asa goes up against Israel, now this is late in his life. This is 31 years after he started to rule. Something changed. He went from this very faith-filled, very zealous for the Lord. All of a sudden, right in this account of him going against Israel, something changed. And man didn't notice. But God did. And it made all the difference. So what was Asa's mistake? Where did he go wrong? And when I see Asa's actions concerning the Israelites, the first thing I see is complacency and laziness. The zeal that he had in chapter 15 with the religious reform, where he hears his voice of the Lord, he seeks out the voice of the Lord, and the Spirit of the Lord comes upon Assyria, and he gives him this prophecy, he cleanses the land of idolatry, and they make a covenant to seek the Lord, the God of their fathers, with all their heart and with all their soul, But that whoever would not seek the Lord, the God of Israel, should be put to death. Whether young or old, man or woman. Man, that is zeal. He's like, man, we need to worship God. He was zealous for God. And that zeal was replaced by 31 years of doing a good job as king. And he got complacent. He started to get lazy with God. And instead of seeking the Lord's direction, he goes off and looks to himself. His own understanding. And it leads him to seek out the help of a man. Instead of relying on God, he ends up relying on man. He puts his hopes in a man, the king of Syria. And Asa makes a soulish decision, a fleshly decision, based on his will and his understanding and what he thinks is right. Now, a few weeks ago, I preached about spiritual maturity and strength. Well, let me tell you, this is a pitfall of spiritual maturity. Instead of relying on the Lord continually and going to Him, we start to rely on methods and things that we think are right. Instead of remaining in that place of connection and submission to the Lord, we start thinking, I'm just going to do this because I think this is right. And hear me here. And we can easily slip from a place of zeal to a place where it looks like zeal, but it's actually against God. We can easily go from a place, not easily, but we can slip to a place of zeal. But without really knowing it, if we just allow our complacency and the way we think and just ourselves to just remain and rise up, we can go from a place of zeal to a thing that looks like zeal. But we can actually be going against God. That's why we have to be alert and aware of what God is doing. We have to be discerning, seeking to hear from the Lord in His word and prayer. And that goes for me, that goes for me, that goes for all of the leaders, all of you guys here. We need to seek out His voice. And it's important because to the average person, things can look great. Like Asa in 1 Kings, it seems like he was doing everything right. But 2 Chronicles tells us something different. He went from zeal to complacency. Stop looking to God. And when you stop looking to God, what do you start looking at? You start to look at yourself. And then you start to look at what you have, what you possess. You start to lean on money and possession. That's what Asa did. And instead of seeking the Lord for the... Like, Lord, this Israel is building this structure right in front of our doors. We're not going to be able to go in or out. We're not going to even go into our territory because they're building this structure and they're fortifying it. Lord, what do we do? Instead of doing that, what does he do? He takes money and he goes and asks a man to help him. He starts relying on man. He starts to have a fear of man. And all of a sudden, the decisions that he's making sound good, but it's not from God. Because he stopped listening to God. And what he had to say a long time ago. It's a very important thing that we are awake and alert. And awake and alert in his word, in prayer, and how he's speaking and how he's moving. And this goes for all of us here. It goes for myself. We can't just, sometimes, I guess it's so easy to just go into auto, auto mode. Even for myself as a pastor, it's so easy for me to just go on autopilot and just think, oh yeah, everything's good, everything, you know, and then we start to rely on yesterday's revelation and yesterday's anointing and what God was doing yesterday, and we stop seeing what he's doing right now. That's why we have to be alert and awake. And God, he rebukes Asa here. He rebukes Asa, and there's so much that we can learn from this rebuke. 2 Chronicles 16:8. I'm going to read it. Were not the Ethiopians and the Libyans a huge army with very many chariots and horsemen? Yet because you relied on the Lord, he gave them into your hand. For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to give strong support to those whose heart is blameless towards him. First thing I want to mention is where he says, "We're not the Ethiopians and the Libyans, a huge army with very many chariots and horsemen. Yet because you relied on the Lord, he gave them into your hand." And what I get from this, we can't forget what the Lord has done. We can't forget what he has done. Stand on your testimonies. Who has a testimony in your life that the Lord showed himself strong? Raise your hand. Stand on your testimonies. And remain in the place of thanksgiving. You want to stay in tune with God? You want to stay in tune with what he is doing and how he is thinking? Live a life of thanksgiving. And true thanksgiving comes with remembering. You can't be thankful without remembering. You can't be thankful without... If, say, like Todd gave me a kidney. I needed a kidney. Todd gives me a kidney. Okay? He saves my life. I'm going to be thankful. And I'm going to remember. Not just that, but tell everybody about it. Every time the word kidney comes up in the sentence, I'm going to be like, man, this brother named Todd gave me a kidney. Somebody eating kidney beans. You're like, man. Speaking of kidneys, there's a great man named Todd. He gave me a kidney. But let me tell you, thanksgiving and remembering what he has done goes hand in hand. If you want to live a life of thanksgiving, you have to stand and remember what he has done. Remember. Don't just say, oh yeah, it's something that happened a long time ago. But remember his testimony. That's what, because if he had remembered, if Asa had remembered what God had done, a million men, have you ever seen a million people? I don't think any of us had seen, literally just looked and with one look of our eyes, seen a million people. You know, the Haeundae, they had this night of prayer in Haeundae about last year. It was pouring rain and there was like a sea of people out on the beach. Right? And they were like, man, this looks like a million people. It ended up being like 50,000, 60,000, 70,000 people. But imagine a million people. I don't think, like when you see the Super Bowl and everybody in there, you're like, yeah, that is not a million people. Imagine a million people standing before you, armed to their teeth, 300 chariots coming, and you have like 300,000 men behind you, and you cry out to the Lord and you defeat them. Wow. Would you not remember that? Wow. If he had remembered that, you know what would have happened? When the Israelites would have started building Ramah and this thing, he would have sought the Lord. Lord, what do we do? But he failed to remember. And so remember to stand on your testimony. Stand on what he has done. When tough time comes, don't look at all the tough time, but look at the testimonies. I'm preaching to myself here. This happens to me all the time. My wife reminds me, oh man, come on. I'm like, yes, yeah. But in moments when we fall into that place of like despair and hopelessness, we gotta stand on the testimony of the Lord. Thanksgiving and remember what he has done. Remember. Number two, for the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth. And when I read this, I see anticipation. He's active in his search. He's not like a guy sitting on a beach watching people walk by. I've done that before. You say, oh yeah, what's up, man? Hey, what's up? How you doing? No! He's actively searching. He's pacing. He's like a boxer about to fight. Come on, come on. Where? I'm looking for it. Where is he at? Come on. Because if I see it, I'm going to give strong support. Whoever. That's how he's searching. And when I saw it, I got reminded of wrestling. Who watched wrestling growing up? WWF, WWE. Man. I was in prison for a while. They watch wrestling a lot in prison. Right? The Monday Night Raw, right? And my favorite was tag team matches. Tag team is when two guys goes against two guys. One person is outside the ring, and one person fights. And when you want to switch, you have to tag. Right? And what happens is usually the guy, the main star, is getting beat up. It's like, he's getting beat up, and he wants to tag. But he can't. He always gets sent to the other corner, and they're all beating him up. And then the person that's on your team, he's in the corner. He's like, come on!
come on, just tag my hand, just tag my hand. Just wait, I'm just waiting, just tag. And then usually the guy's like, oh, almost there. It's almost there. And then, oh, tag. And now he has the right to come in. Boom. And he starts beating up everybody. Oh. Do you guys remember that? Do you guys remember that? Some of you guys are saying, like, man, this man is crazy. I don't know what he's talking about. But there's that moment where teammates, they're about to tag. They want to tag. Because if they tag, the guy on the outside can come in. And he's fresh. He has power. He has energy. He can take down these guys. That's what God is doing. He's searching. He's actively looking to release his power, his strength for those that are reaching up. For the eyes of the Lord run. It's not paid. It's not just like jaunting or skipping. He's running to and fro. When I see that, I see like pacing back and forth, actively looking throughout the whole earth for what? To do what? To give strong support, to show himself strong. He wants to be there for us. Reveal himself, his power, his love, his direction, his will, his perfect way. He wants to pour out his spirit. He wants to give us life. He's like, come on. Just reach up. Ah! Hey, so for those of you guys that don't know wrestling, man, you guys, that's such a good analogy. It really is. Because I remember I would watch those wrestling matches. I was like, man, ah! And then sometimes he would get really close and he would get pulled away. And you're like, no! But he's actively searching to give strong support. To who? To who? It says, who is he looking for? To give strong support to those whose heart is blameless towards him. Now, the word in the ESV is blameless. I don't like that because it denotes sinlessness. Okay, it's not talking about sinlessness because it sounds like sin. But the Hebrew word for this is talking about, the Hebrew word is shalem. And it means complete, safe, peaceful, perfect, whole, full, and at peace. It comes from the same root word as shalom. The root word is shalom. And then it means whole and perfect. And I believe what it's pointing at is the heart. He's looking for a heart that is whole and at peace and at one with God. And with that heart is a heart of faith. God is looking for faith. He's searching this world. He's scouring the earth up and down for people that will stand in faith. Because faith helps us to reach up. He's looking for faith. A heart that is whole in him is one of faith in him. Without faith, it says it's impossible to please God. From Hebrews. And without faith, it's impossible to have a heart that is holy towards him. He's looking for a whole heart, fully trusted in him, knowing that he will do what he says he will do. Listen to that again. He's looking for people whose hearts are fully trusted in him, that knows that he's going to do what he says he's going to do. Now, is your faith in God, or is it in yourself? Is your faith in man? Is it faith in money or in job? In your job? And how is your faith? Because faith is not static, okay? It's not static like your bones. Your bones are pretty much static, okay? Except for Quentin over there. It seems like his bones never stop growing, like 9 feet tall. But for the majority of us, our bones are static, right? 10 years from now, my bones aren't going to be longer than they are right now. It's pretty much going to be the same length. But our muscles are elastic. And our faith is like muscle. Romans 12:3, for by the grace given to me, I say to everyone among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think with sober judgment, listen, each according to the measure of faith that God has assigned. And just like God has given each of us a measure of muscle, he's all given us some measure of muscle, he's given you a measure of faith. And he wants to see what you're going to do with it. Are you going to go and work it out? Put it to the test and make it grow like Noble's muscles? are you going to let it shrink? Are you going to let it? I don't want to give myself as an example. I don't know what. I don't want to make somebody else feel bad. So I'm just going to say, are you going to let it shrink? The faith you were given, if not exercised, won't just stay the same. It'll atrophy. It's going to shrink. Listen to that. The faith, the measure of faith that God gave you, if you don't put that faith to the test, if you don't start standing in faith, it's not just going to stay the same. You know what happens to your muscle if you don't use it? It starts to shrink. And the faith that Asa had when he called upon the Lord, called a million people in front of him, he calls upon the Lord and he defeats it. The faith that he had to do that later had fallen away to a point where he no longer even sought God. We have to stay and remain and test our faith and work out our faith. I want to ask, where is your faith? God is looking for hearts wholly devoted to him in faith, in trust. And he paints us a picture of him running to and fro, scouring this earth, searching for people to release his help. Our God is not a stingy God. He doesn't want us to beg. We think that God is a God that wants us to beg and plead for help. No. He's not a busy God. He's not off playing video games and too busy to do this. He wants us. What he's looking for is faith. Faith. Lord, I know that you're there. I know that I'm going to encounter you. Faith in knowing that he can do all things. Now, our retreat is coming up this week. A lot of us are going. Many of us, we're going and we're given a very valuable opportunity. An opportunity to encounter God who is anticipating encountering you. To pour out into you, to show himself strong. He's like, man, I can't wait till he comes to the retreat. Because it's going to be a place where we gather. And when people gather like this, faith rises up. Let me tell you. It's just the way it is. When people gather together, when faith can be very contagious. I talked about David. I've said this many times. When David killed Goliath, the faith that he had and the courage that he had was very contagious. At the same time, fear is also contagious. Because the same soldiers, just about an hour before, looked at Goliath and said, oh my goodness, what am I going to do? Because you know what? Saul was looking at him. He's like, oh my goodness, what are we going to do? But when people gather in faith, I'm telling you, it's contagious. And it's a very important time, very valuable opportunity for us to encounter him in faith. Are you going with faith, fresh faith? The expectation of him, are you going? Or are you going just because you're going? Because heaven is trying to touch earth. That's what God is doing right now. When he's scouring this earth, it's like heaven coming down, trying to touch earth. And you know what is going to be the part of earth that goes up and touches him? It's faith. It's our faith. Knowing that he is real. Knowing that he can do all things. I want to ask you, is your zeal waning? Some of you guys may have had zeal at one point in your life. It's okay. I've had those moments too where, man, I was so zealous, but then time goes by, like Asa, time goes by, and all of a sudden, it starts to wane. And God's saying, you know what? Now is the time. Stand in faith. Seek me. Is your faith starting to shrink? Measure of faith that God gave you. I'm telling you, if you don't exercise and work at it and continue to go to him with it, because as you continue to go to him, your circumstances might not change, but you know what changes? Your faith grows. A lot of people think that our faith is going to depend on like what we see in the natural and our circumstances. No. That is the complete opposite of faith.
It's the faith, it's the things unseen. It's hope of things unseen. We go to the Lord and we continue to wrestle with it as God. Like this is tough for me. This is hard for me. The situation is, and then you don't see things changing. But you know what is changing? As you continue to go to God, your faith grows. And you're able to see in the Spirit what you don't see in the natural yet through faith. I'm praying for salvation for my dad. I pray for him. But if I don't have faith to see it, you know what? If I don't have faith to see it, if I just pray, you know what? I'm not going to be able to see him saved in the Spirit. Because in the natural, nothing much has changed. 20 years of praying, nothing much has changed. But you know what? If I see it through faith, through the years of me crying out and praying for him, I see it in the Spirit. That's where faith grows. That's where faith is worked out. Let's pray.